Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to 2014 Warbirds in Review. My name is Sam Bass. I've been doing this for about 12 years now. I've been flying for 60 years. I flew 5 years in the Air Force, 35 years at Delta Airlines, 20 years with EAA on the B-17, Ford Tri-Motor and the DC-3. We're going to be emphasizing the Vietnam War this week. And before I get started, could I have all the veterans stand up, please? You know, this is dedicated to the vets in Southeast Asia. And anyone who puts self in harm's way to defend our country is a hero, in my mind. I hope it's the same for you. So at the end of this program, we're going to have General Secord, Dick Welch here. He is a Raven. David Hartman is here. He's going to do the interview with General Secord. And after it's over with, at like last 15 minutes, we'll be having a question and answer system. So think up some good questions. This is all of this Warbirds in Review is by donations. We're not supported by anybody else. And it's primarily by the members of the Warbirds of America. So we would appreciate your membership. Probably only 10% of the people have airplanes here. The rest of us don't. And we have a great magazine. And we would love to have your membership and your support. If you just like to give us a little support, we have a donation pot over there by the Warbirds merchandise. And after this, we will have book signing. We have General Secord's book. And we also have the Raven book. And both of these books should be in your aviation library if you have an aviation library. So they'll be over there in there. Signing them at that time. So without further ado, I'll introduce our people here. Ken Farty is the owner of this T-28. And Ken, in a few minutes here, if you'll come on up, Ken, because he'll be talking to us in a little bit. But Ken is going to be telling us about this T-28, about the restoration of it, and a little bit about the history of it. Now, David Hartman here, everybody knows David Hartman. He's one of the originators and the first host of Good Morning America. He has done over 12,000 interviews. He has done numerous aviation documentaries. He is highly respected in the aviation community. He's one of us. So we think a great deal of him. He's an Air Force veteran. And he's a recipient of the Aviation and Space Writers Journalism Award. And before I go any further, Ken, would you just tell us a little bit about the T-28?
All right, this T-28 is called, the name of it is called a Trojan. And this is a C model, which was used for the carrier qualifications. And as you can see, this one is pretty well decked out for combat, but the T-28 had a much different role in the very beginning. It was a trainer. 1947, they needed a advanced trainer to take the place of their retiring T-6s that were teaching pilots to fly in World War II, and they needed something that would simulate the fighter jets that were coming online at that time. The cockpit in the T-28 is very similar, almost identical to the F-86. So it gave them a better understanding of what they were getting into before they actually went into a jet the early jets. In 1950, they decided that they wanted to replace their T-6s, so they put out a contract, and North American and Lockheed both tried to get it. Lockheed failed, and North American won the contract. And they came out with a T-28 prototype that was basically a T-28 tail dragger. Well, the Air Force looked at it and they said, well, that's really not going to work. We need something that's going to simulate the jets, so we need it to be tricycle gear. So they came back with the tricycle gear, and in 1949, they had two of them, and they tested them, and the Air Force really liked them. So they ended up buying 266 units. Eventually, they bought 1,194 units. And these were the A models. This was a much smaller engine. It had 800 horse. It was a Wright R1300. And it had a steerable nose wheel on it, which the B and the C's never had. And although it was underpowered, it still simulated the jet at slow speed. So they were happy with it, and they used it. After a while, it was around 1950, the Navy and the Marine Corps, they wanted a model for their advanced trainer. So they had them redesign it a little bit. They wanted more horsepower. They wanted a lower canopy. The A model had a very high canopy in it. And they decided that they would redesign this plane, the A model, and they came up with the B model. The B model had 1,425 horsepower, and the B went on into the C, which was what the Navy needed for carrier qualifications. They put a tail hook on it, they beefed up the tail, they beefed up the landing gear, and they shortened the prop for deck clearance. The pilots that flew the 28 early on went into a T-33, and then eventually they went into the F-86, and some of them went into F-80s. There was several versions of the T-28 after they retired them that the general aviation people went and grabbed a few of them. They even made them into five-seat general aviation airplanes. They went from 1,300 horsepower all the way up to 1,535 horsepower. After a while, the Air Force saw these Bs and they thought, wow, We need some more power too. So they ended up grabbing a few of the B models from the Navy, and they ended up making Bs for themselves in their own colors, and they started showing up at Air Force bases. The Trojan was a very versatile trainer, and because it had so much ability to carry armament, it made a great transition plane to go from trainer into fighter. They always had the ability to carry machine guns, rockets, bombs. They even carried external fuel tanks. And eventually, when things started breaking out in Southeast Asia, they realized that they had a great platform, and they took the trainers and they took them back to North America, and they designed what they called the D model for Delta. And what they did was they beefed them up. They gave them extra hard points in the wings. They carried about 3,000 pounds of ordnance, and eventually they actually put ejection seats in them. They had what they call a Stanley Yankee ejection seat. And this plane here is painted in the Southeast Asia camo colors that represents the 1st Air Division, 2nd Fighter Squadron, which is the tiger on the tail, for the South Vietnamese Air Force. It's a very strong airplane. It's rugged, very well built, and it's got a lot of history to it. And you're going to find out some of that history when General Secord talks.
This is Dick Welch here, and he was a Raven.
Yes, sir.
And before to set the stage a little bit about the Ravens, there are a lot of people that don't know about the Ravens. The book here, The Ravens, was written by Christopher Robbins in 1987, and up to that point, there were just a select few people that knew something about the Ravens at all. And there's a little foreword in the book that I'm going to read from you here that'll really kind of set the stage of this. The book was about the war in Southeast Asia from 1961 to 73. It says, quote, "While America and the rest of the world watched on television a handful of elite Air Force pilots wearing anything but uniforms and piloting unarmored, small, prop-driven aircraft fought a secret war, one that remained secret up to this day." That was in 1987. The few pilots who knew about it called it the other theater, a small nation called Laos next to the Ho Chi Minh Trail, China and Thailand. These incredibly brave and skilled pilots were known as the Ravens. Fly low, slow, spot the enemy, and direct winged artillery of American airstrikes from South Vietnam, Thailand, and aircraft carriers. Now, that's what they did. That was their mission. And this is one of them. And this is Dick Welch. And I'll tell you a little bit about Dick here, because he told me about it. He has a DFC with one Oak Leaf Feather, 13 air medals, numerous Laos awards, which he cannot interpret what they are, so he just knows he has them. He flew Covey FAC, and we'll talk about that in a minute, let you explain what that was, in OV-10s prior to that, to the Ravens. So I'm going to give you this mic here, and I'm going to try to get another one. So if you can tell them what Covey FAC is.
Okay, thank you. The Covey FAC was a call sign. Anybody was in Southeast Asia during that time, it was interesting when you came back and you met somebody, you'd say, what was your call sign? But the call sign stayed the same when you left. Somebody, you know, the next people in, they used the same call sign for the same equipment at the same base. So a Covey FAC with a first letter of 5 flew out of Pleiku in the northern, north central Vietnam. But we flew a Covey with a 5 number, flew into Laos on all his missions. So all my missions, even though half my time was based in Vietnam, all my missions were in Laos. And initially I was flying this OV-10, which is a twin-engine turboprop, and had a high speed, and it was considered to be survivable because you were quite maneuverable, so we could go in an area of where they had big guns and look for things moving through. After a while, you figured it out that if you saw a truck laying on its side, they put it there. So that was like a trap. If you went to look at it, the guns were looking for you. That was target practice for them. And if that didn't happen right away, well, that meant they were doing something else nearby, and they were setting a diversion for you while they were moving in the daylight, and they wanted to have any company while they were doing it. And so I did this for about 6 months. In fact, I knew the Raven people were farther in Laos in the cities that were not under siege, and they were flying smaller planes. And I'd see them in the air, and I knew who some of them were. Craig, Craig's last name?
Morrison.
Craig Morrison, yeah, was a Covey FAC in Pleiku, and he left to over there. And Thompson, there's two Thompsons there. And so several people went over, and you know, you took them over there, you saw what they're doing. Pretty obvious what the mission was. And I actually landed the OV-10 on some of these four dirt bases that the people who were supporting them operated. Yeah, that was a real stretch of the rules. And you could see that the rules could get stretched if there was an opportunity, and the rules could back and bite you if somebody wanted to write you up. So a lot of us decided, well, if we went up to Laos.
Is that how you ended up in the, you just met Craig and those people and you knew?
I knew that was going. Actually, if the truth be known, I knew about it years ago when it started up, because I was in B-52s in Barksdale.
Yeah, okay.
And I had, when you're in a B-52 unit, you get lots of security briefings. And
yeah.
Everyone knew about it.
Well, how long were you a fact? Not a fact, but a Raven, excuse me.
The Raven mission is usually about 6 months. Some people say it's
okay, about six months.
6 months at a bite.
Now, were you a forward air controller?
The whole time.
Word fact.
But forward air controller, we meant.
Fact. Forward air controller, yeah. And was that a year prior to that?
A year as a forward air controller, yeah. And then my mission was to identify a target, illuminate it with a smoke rocket, and direct.
What equipment did you fly when you were a Raven?
I'm sorry?
What equipment did you fly?
As a Raven, we flew the 01 Bird Dog, the L-19, if you're an Army guy, same airplane. The O-1 had lots of radios in it, but it was all pretty much the same. We could talk to more people. If we had a direction finder, we could, if somebody wanted to talk to us and they didn't know exactly how to tell us where they were, they said, just keep talking, I'll find you. And it was like a DF steer. And if, I don't know, Kevin's.
Well, who did you have in the back seat when you were flying?
Well, that was the interesting thing. Sometimes they had them, sometimes they didn't, and sometimes they wanted to leave halfway through the mission. Honest to God, I had a guy try to, you know, leave the airplane. We were coming back after dark, and it was a little. We're stretching the envelope of even for an O-1 because it got dark, and in the dark you can't see anything. There's no lights on the ground, and the instrumentation is the blue lights. Some of the older pilots would know the black light that illuminates the radium dial. That's all you had, and you didn't have very much of that. And I could hear my backseater kind of rustling around, and when I reached over, he was out of the airplane, and I reached out and grabbed his belt and pulled him back in, put him in the seat. And now, if I can grab his belt, you saw the earlier guy, he didn't have a parachute. He's just going to get out of the airplane. And that really, really happened. And he was multilingual. These people were educated, the people I worked with and along the river. They'd gone to schools, they could speak multiple languages, but their concept of physics, they didn't have a physics course, apparently, because they had some ideas that would cause you to say, how could anybody was, you know, they talk English to you, you get the idea that they know what you know. That's not true. They had some ideas that they were their own, and if you got to know them, they would start to explain things in the way they knew it. You've been to Southeast Asia, you've been to the Buddhist temples in Bangkok, where those big statues are outside. Well, the people that I worked with, when we talked, I'd say, well, those are statues of the giants that you're worried about. And he said, no, those are the giants. I said, well, why don't they move? And he said, well, they don't want to, but they could. This is the people I was working with. And they were in the back seat, and they knew the people. The biggest thing in difference in translation was that when I talked about things, I talked about coordinates, maybe 8-digit coordinates and detailed maps, and they would talk in terms of the names of little towns because they lived there. They knew people who lived there. And so translating whether I wanted them to come to a Lima site, and they'd give it the name of the closest village and talk about it that way. Very frequently, we'd have to divert on our way home because people in the newspaper business were over there with their cameras, and you know, the CBS and ABC guys would want to film us and interview us as we came back from a mission. So we'd just go to Thailand instead.
Dick, can you just give us a typical mission?
Typical mission would be
what time you left and
daylight only. We didn't fly dark. So we'd take off early in the morning, and we'd more often than not we'd have the coordinates of some place that the CIA, the road team people had identified. There's a building out there full of munitions. And we'd go out there and you'd fly over it and it's double canopy, you can't see anything. You could put some ordnance on it, but you probably wouldn't get it, and if you did, they'd just move it, or the next day they'd have guns there. So we would fly over the targets that they had identified. The intelligence is really good. And if we saw an opportunity that something was moving, well, we'd just go to that. But the one I'm thinking about is a building as big as one of these hangars. It was in double canopy, and each of the four guys at PAC-SE looked at it for 2 or 3 days in a row, and finally the agency guys come by, hey, don't you pay attention to us, you know? And he said, well, we pay attention, but if we hang out, they'll put up some guns and shoot us down. So we all took turns going over at different times of the day, and once we were out there, we would stop at these dirt strips and refuel. So you'd leave PAC-SE in the morning. It was a place much like this, a paved road and runway and all. But most of the time during the day, you were flying in and out of dirt strips that were only open during the day. If you came to one in the late in the afternoon and the CIA guys weren't there, we didn't know if it was in our control. You couldn't land. But anyway, we did get a big building finally the sun was just right, and you could see the Ridge Building. And we put T28 napalm on it, and it burned for all day and went up about 3,000 feet. It was mixed munitions for sure, because you could see different kinds of color smoke and different tracers coming out of it, and it really set them back.
Did you feel like when you finished your tour of duty that you had been effective? That what you guys were doing was
effective. By zip code, yeah, we kept them back on their heels, and where I was, this was after we went into Cambodia in May of 70, and their reaction to that was they moved the Ho Chi Minh Trail closer to the people, the Royal Lao and Pak Say that we were supporting, mm-hmm. So it became more intense for them, and to keep them back at their old property line, which is about halfway across Laos, we sent them back.
Did you have any particular rules of engagement that you thought were idiotic while you were there?
Not that I can remember.
let me put it this way. Are there any rules of engagement that you were supposed to go by that you felt like were...
Well, the detailed answer to that is when you came into the country, you went to Vientiane, which is like an administrative cat. It was the biggest city. Don't tell the people it's Savannah Cat. The ambassador was in a compound, and they'd have a Friday night meeting. And this, I was just standing around looking for who was looking for me. And he was lowish, really not very tall. And he got up right close to me and said, "Hey, you must be the new Raven." I said, "Who the hell wants to know?" I was a security thing. Yeah. And he said, "Well, I'm the ambassador here." I backed up, "Oh, yeah, yes, you are." He was Ambassador Gottlieb at the time. And so I said to him, "You're the ambassador for the United States, recognized by the Royal Lao government. You carry out the foreign policy that comes to you through the president and to me through you." And he said, "That's right." So anybody, I decide this is a target. He said, "That's right." I said, "Well, I get in the jam, I'll call you. And I don't expect to call you." Okay. And that was my understanding of the rules of engagement directly from the ambassador to me. And I figured I was working with the government, and I had the clearance to do what I thought I'd have to do.
All right, thank you, Dick.
Our next guest is Dick Secord. He graduated from West Point in 1955, earned his Silver Wings in 56, had a distinguished 28 years as an Air Force officer, has a master's degree in international affairs from GW, finished the programs Air Command and Staff and the Naval War College at Newport. He spent a number of years as an instructor, but then in the early 60s became part of that first Air Commando wing, flying AT-28s, hundreds of missions in Southeast Asia. And then in the mid-60s, he was transferred to Udorn in Thailand, and that's what we're going to hear about. This is General Dick Secord.
Thank you, David. I started, as he said, flying the AT-28. The Defense Department redesignated this particular genre of 28s, the AT-28, in the early 60s. And it had a number of models, as you've been told, carry about 3,500 pounds of ordnance. I never met a pilot who didn't like this airplane. It was agile. It was strong, took battle damage greatly, and so on. I could go on about it all day. My first tour of duty in South Vietnam was started in 1962, flying T-28, AT-28Bs at the time. And we were not allowed to log our missions during most of that tour because we weren't there.
What percentage of your missions that you flew were classified?
All of them. The cover was that we were there on training missions. I can honestly say, while I was in Vietnam at least, never flew any training missions. So,
are they declassified now?
Yes, they were declassified in the 80s. And
how much can you tell us about what some of those missions were? What type of missions were they?
Well, they were largely close air support missions, helicopter, troop lift escort missions, rescue missions, and a few interdiction missions. The majority was close air support of South Vietnamese air troops in contact.
Is there any way you know how many missions you flew?
I had 285 logged, so probably around 400. But we didn't know, and we didn't keep track of them early on. They reversed that late in 1962.
So when did you move over to Thailand to Udorn, that reassignment?
I went back to South Vietnam briefly in 1966, and then I was on detail with CIA for 3 years as an air officer. And they used to call us Christmas help. They needed some airmen, and seemed like an exciting thing to do. So I was able to volunteer for that. Spent the next 3 years. They moved me. They didn't intend to assign me to Saigon. They moved me up to Laos instead, where I was chief of the the air liaison branch, which meant tactical air, helicopter infiltration, exfiltration, that sort of thing. Like everybody in Laos, as was mentioned earlier, we're under supervision of the ambassador. During the time I was there, we didn't have quite such a friendly ambassador, but wish we had. But we did have a few rules that seemed ridiculous at the time, like we could not strike targets more than 1 kilometer off of a motorable road and so on. But the motorable roads weren't really roads, they were just wide open areas and hard to identify. I was there when the forward air control force that Dick Welsh here mentioned to you was created, and it was created because the U.S. Air Force commander did not want enlisted people controlling our jet fighter strikes, by and large, and so they brought officers in, and it became quite a successful program. We put one of their operating bases at each of the 5 CIA operating locations, which was really a tremendous thing. As I mentioned earlier, we had intelligence fusion before they invented that term, and because our forward air controllers were living with, eating with, drinking with, flying under the control of the CIA chiefs in each of the 5 locations, and it turned out to be extremely effective in many, many, many cases.
Would you explain the politics of why we had to go into Laos, which was a neutral country according to Geneva Accords? So what forced us to go in there?
The Geneva Accords, signed in 1962, neutralized, theoretically, that area. Unfortunately, the enemy did not withdraw at all and, in fact, increased their presence. And although they denied it always to the end, I think they still denied it. And we weren't there either, and we denied it. So we're both not there.
How challenging was it to keep all this secret? I mean, from the American public.
It was an effort, but not nearly so great an effort as the people today face, because we didn't have round-the-clock news cycles and omnipresent television and that sort of thing. So that classified covert operation was pretty well, as near as I can tell, maintained throughout the 60s and into the 70s. As was mentioned, in the 70s, we expanded the Air Force clandestine operation into Cambodia as we were going back in there, and we had a Cambodian Air Force improvement plan, which once again was our forward air control Laos plan redux in Cambodia. And we moved a number of the guys who were involved in the Laotian program south into Cambodia during this effort. So the AT-28 served in combat in all 3 of the Indochina countries for a long, long time. Everybody knows and reveres the the Mustangs and the Thunderbolts and the P-38s and so forth. Almost nobody knows about the AT-28s, which actually served in combat longer than any of those birds did. So it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. The pilots who flew these airplanes were exceptionally bold, and the casualty rates were significant, no doubt, but the damage that they wrought was just disproportionate to their numbers. We only had about 100 of these airplanes at any given time.
Who was the enemy, just North Vietnamese, or were there others? When you said, okay, who were your targets? Who were they?
Well, the enemy was primarily the North Vietnamese Army, but they had their co-opted forces in South Vietnam, the Viet Cong, which were Vietnamese, of course, the Pathet Lao and Laos, which were Laos, but they were pretty, they were tame. We can handle them easily. It was the North Vietnamese Army that we had to contend with, and they, of course, were supported by the Soviet Union at the time, logistically. It was a pretty determined foe, as we found.
I recall it was President Eisenhower who talked about the domino theory, and as I recall, said that that Laos was the first domino to fall, and for that reason, we had to block the North Vietnamese from Laos. How successful were we?
Well, I think that was the impetus for the 62 Accords, which were signed during the Kennedy administration. And the so-called domino theory was quite prevalent in those times. Whether or not it bore fruit or not is still a subject of debate among scholars. But the scholars weren't fighting the war, and we were. And I think we did it effectively. Had we had more reasonable rules throughout, we would have prevailed absolutely. The evidence of that is the 12 days of Christmas in 1972, when our Air Force just pulverized, our Air Force and Army, Navy, aviation pulverized North Vietnam. In 12 days, they had them on their knees. Had we done that 10 years earlier, or 8 years, or 5 years earlier, I think it would have been a different outcome. But, that's the way it goes.
As you look back, your extended career, extended into policy, defense policy at the highest levels for many, many years, as you look back now over the Vietnam War, how could we have prosecuted it more effectively?
Interdicted the Ho Chi Minh Trail with troops rather than trying to do it with forward air controllers and tactical air, and struck north as we did in linebacker 2 at the same time, it would have been over in a fortnight.
Dick, as you listen to your colleagues here who were there fighting as you were, what memories does it bring back for you on a day like this in this circumstance? We were all trying to remember and recall and honor the people who fought there.
Don't want to start. We got 2 or 3 hours here? I agree with everything the general said on that, because he saw it from a bigger picture. Yeah, I was down in the weeds. One thing I did think strike me when he was talking about it is that we did intercept what we called the bomb damage assessment. We knew what we struck. But there was radio signals that they'd send back to say what we had done a few days later. And there was an indication that they subdivided their casualties. And they did differentiate between Asians and non-Asians. And there was a fair amount of participation of non-Asians on the other side. And that I'm sure of. And I think it's significant. We were trying to keep it out of the news, but it was pretty active away game for both of us.
Non-Asians. Russians? Who?
Non-Asians is all they said. Volunteers from wherever, Romania, Bulgaria. At that time, there's a Soviet Union. There's a lot of countries. It could have been Russians. It could have been English. But sometimes they spoke really good English. And sometimes they come up on the radio, and they talk to you. And sometimes they give you intel about a target. And sometimes their English was just a little bit too suave, because as good as they were, the Lao people, they were multilingual, but English was their third or fourth language. You know? French was their best English, best American, you know, Europeanish, our language. So at a time, we had instruments in our airplanes that we could tell where they were talking from. And they could talk themselves into being the recipient of an airstrike. That could happen.
Dick, he mentioned that you were, saw the big picture in your position. As he describes this, were there moments when, or to what extent were there moments when you sensed, you know what, we've got to increase our participation here, we've got to do more, or we've got to do it in a different way?
Well, there was no magic moment for me. I kind of grew up with that war and spent a lot of years in it. But as time wore on, it became more and more clear to me that as long as we kept our hands tied, and we did keep them tied politically in many ways, for instance, not sending troops across the Ho Chi Minh Trail because of the Geneva Accords, which the enemy didn't even give a nod to, much less comply with, it became more and more clear to many people my age that that it was lost. We just couldn't prevail if we kept this up. And of course, the American people are not well known for their patience with long wars, and that's what happened to us in that one. It ran out of airspeed and altitude about the same time. And just that's an unfortunate part of history. I think we see a lot of that repeating itself now, which is truly ironic and amazing to me. I've been working on a book with another guy on the history of special operations, which has nothing to do with this speech, but a working title is "We Haven't Learned a Damn Thing." I think that's correct. So. In my book, a plebe cadet would have done better on strategy than we managed to do, which is a sad thing to say. That may be the result of a republic. I don't know, but history will tell.
But how much of that was politics, and how much was just lack of strategy and tactics?
Well, I think it was all politics. There are books written on the various strategic and tactical errors, dereliction of duty being the most famous one by Masters. But I think ultimately, of course, it rests on the shoulders of the political leaders at the time, and it wasn't just one administration. It went on and on. And it just, as I said, I'm just suggesting that that may be why the republics haven't lasted long in history, because when it comes to war, you got to get your act together. You got to pay attention to what you're doing and know what your objective is. And that was our objective to begin with in Southeast Asia, was to ensure the territorial integrity of South Vietnam. But that mission crept, and necessarily so, I think, because the enemy expanded its operations as well. And so, scholars argue over this, but it's clear in my mind.
The book that he just mentioned, by the way, that he's recommending it, and I am as well, it's by a now Army three-star general, H.R. McMaster, who's also an historian, and he wrote this brilliant book about the Joint Chiefs and about the president back in the late 60s, Dereliction of Duty. Highly recommend it to understand what was going on during the years that we're talking about. Sam, we're ready for some Q&A?
We're short on here. We're going to have the Q&A section, and Danny is here. He comes. He's going to come out here. What we'll do is if you have a question, Danny will bring the mic to you. Please wait till you get the mic, or he tells you, and he'll respond to it, and then we'll have some. Jack, would you come up here? We have another Raven here, and he's going to kind of help us with the Q&A if you have anything. Just have a seat there. Anybody got a question? Over here, Danny. And just, Melissa's over here.
Just relayed a question to me.
What was the dispatch rate of the A-28? How reliable was it out in the field?
Oh, it was great. It was perfect. You couldn't build a better airplane. The Laotian fellows were really confident. I was there in about the middle of it, and the training had been set up and all. They were professionals, and they just didn't make mistakes. The ordnance all worked. They had bombs, rockets, strafe, CBU, napalm, whatever they wanted, they had it, and they'd show up in 20 minutes. I don't know how they did that. It took me a half an hour to get to where I was, and I called for something, and there it was. And it always worked, and they always hit the target. Just couldn't be better. And everything was reliable. Everything was in its right place. And I believed in that. I had confidence in the airplane to the point where I let them teach me how to fly it by swapping time in my O-1 for time in the T-28. That's a real casual checkout. I don't, Jack, some people had casual checkouts. That's casual.
Got one right here, Sam.
Dick also told me in a conversation that General Secord and his group was responsible for them having exactly everything that they wanted. And that's something that they need, General Secord and his group need to be recognized for providing these people with what they needed. Next question.
Thank you also for your service. Do any of you have one mission that really stands out as your favorite, this thing I'll never forget in my life, no matter how long I live?
Let's let Jack do one here.
And my second question is, do you have a favorite loadout? Did you guys prefer napalm? You name it.
I was there at the end of the war, so I guess I won it. Okay. But the hostility ceased while I was a Raven. My favorite loadout, of course, was a T-28 that we would get. I flew the O-1, but whenever we had a call for air and the Laotian Air Force would show up, our favorite loadout was napalm because they hated fire. They were deathly afraid of fire. And we put napalm down, everybody would run. Our side, their side, they'd just take off. So that was our favorite one for getting things to stop. My favorite mission, if you want to call it a favorite, most memorable mission, was my second day on the job. I went to Vientiane and checked out in the O-1 and went down to Pak Se, and I flew twice with my old roommate, Hal Mishler. And then the next day, I had the morning off, in the afternoon, I was flying with a guy named Lou Hatch. Lou Hatch was a classmate of mine from the Air Force Academy. But he had been there 2 months more than me, so he was the brown bean and I was the green bean, and he was giving me a check ride. And we're out doing the thing, and Hal Mishler, the guy I had flown with the day before, was in another area. He got shot down. So check ride, can that thing, let's go do our job. We went over and worked the SAR, and we got shot down. And so it was not a good day for the Ravens. This is 23rd of December 1972, 2 days before Christmas. And Hal died, and we didn't, because Ed Chun diverted the planes coming to get Hal to pick us up as we crashed on this little airstrip. And then the next day, Skip Jackson died in a plane de jars from a midair with an A-7. But what I remember about that is when we got back to the hooch that night after it was getting dark, and I walked in with Lou, and there on the table were two bottles of Johnny Walker Black. And I'm going, what's this? And I said, it's scotch. It's for you two guys. And I said, no. We're supposed to buy them the scotch. They're the ones that picked us up. We owe them the scotch. And they go, no. They made more money than you did today. Air America got paid to pick up downed pilots. And I said, whatever it is, I'll double it. That's great. So we drank one bottle that night and the other one the next night. And but during the course of the evening, I looked at Lou and I said, Lou, we never finished the check ride, you know, so I've got to go back and finish the check ride. He looks at me and he goes, you know, you're unsafe to fly with. So if I don't pass you, I'm going to have to pass you. I'm going to have to fly with you again. So he sat there in a bar and he goes, Omni, Omni, VOR, you're now checked out. And that was the end of my check ride.
Yes, sir.
He mentioned Air America. Yeah, that's true. They got paid, but not very much, let me tell you. And they worked under my shop for a long period of time, and they picked up more pilots than our Jolly Greens did over time in Laos. They were truly heroic, not properly recognized for this.
Yeah, there was one named Jerry Williams. Do you remember him? He did some of that. He's not with us anymore. Talking about favorite ordnance, I got to inject it. The favorite ordnance for the T-20A guys was the CBU. They were in 6-2. A cluster bomb unit. If you look over there on one of those other planes, they have a six, if you look at it from the back, it's a triangle of six round tubes. They're like about the size of a drain pipe. And the tube was filled with these black hand grenades. They were so big, you couldn't throw them away from you to not, you know, get out of safe range. But that's about what they were. And they'd come out and they'd spin around an arm and they'd go off over a large field. Well, the T-28 guys in PAC-SA liked to dispense these. They were good weapons, but they really liked to dispense them because the tubes were one-time use. And they could take the tubes downtown and sell them for multiple of what they got paid for the mission. We're talking about money. They got several times in compensation. But what would happen is, invariably, one CBU unit would get hung up and not come out. And, you know, landing is just enough of a jar to solve that problem. And so you'd have this CBU unit rolling down the runway behind them, and did it arm or did it not arm? Is it going to go off by itself? And it would shut down operations. It must have happened the time I was in PAC, say, four times. And I remember being on the ground and seeing it, and guys would have to come in from Savannah Cat or some other place that explosive ordnance disposal, and I don't know why they dug a hole near it and pulled it in. And that must have cost us thousands of dollars. And, you know, some alternative of, you know, pay the guys $10 and so they wouldn't. But they did. They insisted on bringing these back to scavenge them and take them downtown. Not all the pilots were in that situation. The pilot's skill was the same all over. They interacted with each other during the day as they were all equal, but some of them got in the new cars and went home, and some of them got on a bicycle or caught a ride or somebody. They weren't all from the same background. But the people who were running the country were among the pilots, and they were really clever people. Other than the war, I really liked meeting those people.
Danny, you had one more over there? Danny, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to remind people that today was the anniversary of the incident on the Forrestal when 135 sailors died in service to their country. They're having a ceremony right now at the Wall in Washington with the Forrestal Association, and I told them I would mention it here so we could maybe give them a moment of silence.
Sam, anybody else?
He asked for a moment.
We'll do that in just a minute.
Okay.
Well, in 1970, I was a 17-year-old kid going to high school in Taiwan, and I was on a train from Taipei to Tainan, and there was a gentleman who had must have been 30,000 ounces of gold on his wrist. Could you guys tell us the story about that? And also, who's Magnet Butt?
What was the last one?
Who's Magnet Butt?
Oh, Magnet, that's Fred Platt. He was actually in pilot training with me in 1967E. We were the first class to have T-38s in Laredo. He was pretty strange, and most of the book is around Fred because he got a collar around Christopher Robbins, and he dragged him around to interview everybody, but he filtered all the interviews, and somehow the stories all came back to Fred. Not that they're not true, but they were kind of skewed his way. I was not where he was. He was injured and out before I went in. In fact, I saw him injured at the Udorn Club with a big collar on, raising cane, and helped me make up my mind to go in. If he could do it, I could do it. the other part was... the gold. We all bought the gold from Billy Fong, who was a jeweler in Vientiane. And he was a Chinese agent. Everybody knew it. And that we were very confident that he wasn't skimming us, because he didn't need to. And that was the only way the Chinese government could get American dollars at that time, because we didn't recognize them. And this was the vehicle. And we bought the jewelry at, it was $35 an ounce of gold at that time. And we bought the jewelry, like this big bracelet, for $35 an ounce. With labor's kicked in, you know. So we bought really gaudy, huge necklaces. Now, the Air America guys had them, but to reinforce back up what General Secord is, they didn't come close to as big as ours. Everybody had a Raven. Oh, just outrageous bracelet, at least one. And the Four Seasons bracelets, they had little patterns on them and all kinds of chains. And it, we knew we were buying them from Billy Fong, and we were confident. They were so confident in us, and they knew who we were. I went in to see him. He had one made up with my name on it, and he took my check and didn't even ask for my driver's license. Now, how's that? And that's true. It was 10 ounces, and it was $238.
Well, got one more question here, and then make it short.
I was with 42nd 28th Strategic Bomb Wing with the B-52s. Did you all ever coordinate what you did with SAC, and did you ever talk to SAC about the mission and try to accomplish the same thing?
Nobody coordinated with SAC, and they didn't coordinate with anybody very well. That was one of the weaknesses that exhibited itself in the 12 days of Christmas. They would not relinquish operational control of the B-52s to the 7th Air Force, and they suffered quite a few unnecessary casualties. So, but that's the way it worked. Maybe that's why we don't have a SAC anymore.
Thanks again, folks. Let's have that moment of silence, if you will. Thank you, folks.